80 years ago, Amelia Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. All over the world lie scattered pieces of her puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to the Chasing Earhart podcast. I'm your host and the project creator, Chris Williamson. Hello and welcome to the Chasing Earhart podcast. I am your host, Chris Williamson. Welcome to episode 10. Now, before we dive into this week's episode of Chasing Earhart, I want to touch on something that we are kind of working on creating at the moment, and we have several individuals and several organizations involved in creating it. And it's going to take place at the Amelia Earhart Festival in Atchison, Kansas, next summer, July 21st, which is a Saturday. The event is called Chasing Earhart, and it is going to be a one-of-a-kind panel that we're going to be bringing to the event. There's going to be a lot of people on the panel that have never been to Atchison before, never been to the Amelia Earhart Festival, and we're going to be giving you guys some names in just a few moments here. But the idea behind this panel is to world premiere the theatrical trailer for Chasing Earhart first, and once that trailer has been premiered, we're going to be having a discussion on the impact and legacy of Amelia Earhart, the Chasing Earhart project itself, and how all the individuals on the panel kind of play into that project, and what they believe is Amelia Earhart's resonance and impact 80 years, of course, 81 years at that point after she disappeared. So we're going to be discussing a lot of different things in the panel itself, and at the end of the panel for maybe the last 30 minutes or so, we're going to open it up to discussion with the audience, Q&A. Now, the St. Benedictine College Auditorium seats approximately 500 people. We will not be charging admission for this panel. It is completely free. It's a first-come, first-served basis. We are probably going to be working out something so that our subscribers can be the first to get admission to the panel if they decide they want to come out for it. But we are going to have a really unprecedented guest list for the panel. Now, the idea is obviously not to bring all 150 individuals involved in Chasing Earhart, but to bring a representation of those individuals. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to briefly go through that representation right now. So on the panel, we're negotiating with right now these following individuals, and it's looking pretty good for all of them. Abigail Harrison, who we talked to in episode 7. She's the founder of the Mars Generation, and she's an incredible representation of Amelia Earhart's spirit in 2017. Very special guest, Neil deGrasse Tyson. I don't really need to say any more. He is Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's a worldwide phenomenon, and I think it's going to be exciting to have him kind of participate in the panel. Author Brad Meltzer, who we're working with right now to negotiate for the panel, to sit in. He's a New York Times bestselling author. He wrote I Am Amelia Earhart, which is a children's book that just released. We're going to be actually having Brad on the podcast hopefully in the next couple of weeks here, and we'll be discussing the panel with him on that podcast episode. Tom King, who is our inaugural guest. He's a senior archaeologist for Tiger. Scott Philbrook and Forrest Burgess, who are the co-hosts and creators of Astonishing Legends and that podcast. They have an amazing podcast. We're going to be doing a cross-promotion with them in the next month or so. You can look out for that, and they'll be on the panel. The World Flyers will be represented by Amelia Rose Earhart and Ann Pellegrino. And we also have Congressman Larry Inman, who is going to be sitting in on the panel, who we'll be shooting with for the documentary actually tomorrow in Atchison, Kansas. Author Kate Jerome, who wrote Who Was Amelia Earhart, which is a children's book that was is still on the Amazon bestseller list for Amelia Earhart books. Todd Swindell of Protecting Earhart and the Irene Bolam Hypothesis. And Dr. Anita Sengupta is also being negotiated with right now, who is the, she works for JPL, and she was the individual who headed up the team that created the supersonic parachute for the Curiosity rover that sits on Mars as we speak. So it's a very interesting group of individuals and a very fascinating and incredible group of individuals, and we're going to have a lot of fun with that. So be on the lookout for more information on our website, on our social media. Our team is on it, and they'll be telling everybody about it. There'll be a lot of heavy promotion for this panel. It'll really officially launch the project. It'll be about a year out from the release of the project itself, so we're very excited to kind of announce, preliminarily anyway, announce the panel that's in the works and the individuals that we're working on having for the panel. So that's that. Now let's get into this week's guest. Now, this week's guest is author Robert Wheeler. Now, he co-wrote a book back that was released in July of 2012 called Amelia Earhart Betrayed. He co-wrote it with his friend Harold Nicely. And we're honored to have Robert on the podcast. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to briefly introduce the book that we're going to be discussing and kind of taking apart here. And I think it's important because some of the information that's in the original book is actually different from the information that they have now as they're kind of keeping their investigation open and working their hypothesis. So let's talk a little bit about this book. This dramatic, controversial novel, it's not your typical Amelia Earhart biography or dry report. It's authored by two expert pilots who ask pivotal questions, and they provide valuable pieces to the, at the time, 75-year-old puzzle about Earhart's mysterious disappearance. Some of the questions that they cover in the book are very pertinent, very relevant. Were they on a secret mission to photograph Japanese installations? Who kidnapped them? Was FDR part of the government cover-up that continues to this day? We're going to talk to him. We're going to climb into the cockpit with Amelia Earhart, who famously said, "Adventure is worthwhile in itself." And we're going to get into all of it with Robert Wheeler. So without further ado, Robert, you're up. Our guest today on the Chasing Earhart podcast is author Robert Wheeler. He co-wrote a book called Amelia Earhart Betrayed, and we're very happy to have him here. Robert, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
So what I want to do is I want to start this interview the same way I start every interview. Can you tell everybody out there that's listening a little bit about your educational and your professional background?
Basically, I was in the military most of my life, joined in 1966 and retired in 2005. I was a helicopter pilot and ended up as a helicopter / fixed-wing pilot towards the last of my career. I was an instructor pilot, instrument flight examiner, and have been interested in Amelia Earhart since reading Fred Goyner's book in 1967. On my way to Vietnam.
So how did she come into your life then? Was that the first initial contact that you had with Amelia Earhart?
Oh, no. I was born in 1945, so I've known about Amelia Earhart a long time. And I've always heard the crash and sink theory that I thought all the time growing up that that's what happened. She just crashed in the ocean. But then I read Fred Goyner's book, and it opened up a whole new horizon. I think he was the first one to suggest that that wasn't what happened. And so I became curious. And I've been basically, she's been on again, off again. But then back in 2010, I believe it was, or 2009, I began talking to a good friend of mine, Fred Nicely, who co-authored the book with me. And he and I started talking about it. He basically felt the same way. We started talking about it, and then we started researching in earnest.
So what made you and Fred decide you wanted to put out this book collectively? I mean, was that a joint decision? How did that come to pass?
We thought that by writing something about her, our own opinions, what we tried to do was take all of the main theories of what happened to her and roll them into a book. It was basically so that people wouldn't forget her. Of course, I don't think there's really that much danger anymore, but we just wanted to make sure that people remembered her. And what we did was we rolled our story around all of the popular theories at the time. And we did a lot of investigating on our own, and we only put in ones, of course, that we felt were plausible.
So how does one do that when you're researching all this data and all these different hypotheses that are out there and that are either been worked in the past or are currently being worked now? How does one differentiate between what's possible, what's probable, what data makes the book, what data doesn't make the book? How did you guys go about doing that?
I think that's what you have to do with each and every story or with each and every theory. You have to look at it individually and find out if it holds up. That's one of the reasons we are continually investigating. There's a lot of things in the book that we don't feel are true anymore. And several of the theories or the things that we expressed in the book have basically fallen apart under really close inspection and what we've had to work with. So there's a lot of the book that not a lot of the book, but there's parts of the book that we don't feel are true.
You know, one of the most interesting things that I think I've gotten out of our email exchanges before this chat is early on in our email exchanges, you had mentioned that you know, you feel that a true investigation is a living thing. It grows and shrinks and changes directions as new facts come to light. And you just touched on that just a few moments ago about, you know, some of the stuff not being, the same as it was when you wrote the book. How does one approach, you know, natural skepticism, even in their own hypothesis and even in their own work? How does one do that when you're writing a book or you're researching a hypothesis, even if it is your own?
I think that's probably one of the most important parts of an investigation is, first of all, if you question somebody else, you also have to question yourself. Unless, of course, you have privy to knowledge that nobody else has, which very few people do in this regard. There's only a very few facts that we have to deal with as far as Amelia Earhart's concerned. And when I say facts, I mean truly verifiable facts, and we have to work from those. The problem with a lot of theorists is they build their theories on not only the facts, but what other people have said. And that was one of the faults with the book, was we built a lot of our writings on other people's theories. And then basically about 3 years ago, we started tearing apart everybody as far as their theories, as far as our theories are concerned. We have papers that we wrote that we go back and look at on the website, and we keep them on the website until we can correct them. And the way we will correct them is to write another paper saying how we feel now. And you can look in comparison and see how our opinions have changed.
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting how you just stated that and how you can kind of change your hypothesis and change what you believe around. Can you talk a little bit about how that process works? What does one have to see, hear, do in order to change their current hypothesis and maybe alter it or sway it to something that's evolving into something new or a different variation of that particular hypothesis?
The first thing is you have to start taking the hypothesis and starting at square one with their hypothesis. What are they basing their assumptions on? What are they? Because when it comes to Amelia Earhart, most everything we make assumptions based on what we feel are pertinent facts. So you have to start right at ground zero and go from there. If you don't go from ground zero, then you're building it on something that may or may not be true.
So we all know about inductive and deductive reasoning from previous podcasts and then some future podcasts that we'll be working on. But what I want to ask you about now is the role that skepticism plays in working a particular hypothesis. Take any hypothesis that you want, really. How does skepticism play out in a situation like this? What role does it play, and how do you handle that?
I think it's really difficult to be to have the right amount of skepticism. Too little skepticism, and you're going to let things go by that shouldn't. Too much skepticism, and you're going to discount things that probably are pertinent. So I think probably one of the most difficult things about investigation is the right amount of skepticism. Skepticism it's a good thing, but with too much, it can be a bad thing. It's typical of a lot of law enforcement agencies. They have a tendency to believe that no one, not even their own mother, tells the truth. And that's too much skepticism. It clouds their vision.
So we've talked about how it's changed over the course of these last couple of years since you've written the book. But what I want to do now is I want to shift into talking about exactly what your hypothesis is. Can you let everybody know out there what you believe actually happened to Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan and what that hypothesis is?
Currently, we believe that Amelia Earhart took off from Ley, New Guinea at 10 o'clock local, 12 midnight Greenwich Mean Time, which I will, if permissible, call Zulu time from now on, because that's what I'm used to calling it. She took off at 12 Zulu, and she had approximately 24 hours of fuel in her aircraft, flying at the prescribed flight mode that Kelly Johnson had suggested in his telegrams. she basically made her last transmission 20 hours and 13 minutes into her flight, meaning, of course, that she had 3 hours and 37 minutes of fuel left. That's just one of the reasons that we have a problem with the crash and sink theory, that all of a sudden she just gave up and crashed in the ocean. I have a hard time with that. But what we believe is that she flew for that 20 hours and 13 minutes and basically simply got lost. Even though she had one of the foremost navigators on board, we feel like that she got lost and ended up landing at Maile Atoll in the Marshall Islands.
So if you're an Amelia Earhart aficionado or a researcher or a fan of Amelia Earhart, you know that name and you know that island. Maile Atoll has been talked about in a lot of different folks' various work and research and hypotheses that are out there. What I want to ask you is, how did she come down into Maile Atoll? Did she have to put the plane down in an emergency landing? Was she shot down? Could she put it down without injuring her and Fred? What happens next once they actually touch down in Maile Atoll?
I think at that point, she landed the aircraft, of course, not perfectly. And if you look at the Marshall Islands, I can bring it up at this point. The Marshall Islands produced a stamp in 1987 to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the loss. And they showed her aircraft on the beach or close to the beach. And it was the right wing had come off, right, just outboard of the right engine nacelle. And that becomes pertinent in our investigation, actually. But the Maile Island theory is really a Maile Atoll, I should say. It's a group of different islands, but we feel like that that's where she landed and that she did survive the crash. However, according to eyewitness testimony, Fred Noonan rather had a head injury, that she probably wasn't injured, but he had a head injury and a leg injury, which would be typical of a crash sequence where he would probably have hit his knee on the instrument panel and also his head when he lurched forward. We feel certain that he was most likely in the right seat of the aircraft at the crash, at the point of the crash. But she survived probably with a few cuts and bruises and they both got out of the aircraft.
So I just want to ask you point blank, because I think it's a good way to do this, and we can just kind of work our way down from there. It's been widely speculated that Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan were on some sort of a spy mission for the United States government and FDR. Let's talk about that just to kind of get it out of the way, if nothing else. Point blank, was she on a spy mission? What do you think happened?
We believe she was, but not on this leg of the flight. Her secret mission was to come later on from Howland to Hawaii. And that is a, we feel, supportable hypothesis. But no, she was not on any sort of secret mission, which is what we outline in the book, of course, that she was on a secret mission to photograph Truk Atoll. Then simply didn't find Howland Island. Well, we feel like in this particular instance that she didn't find Howland Island. Of course, that's one of the facts that we can pretty much hang our hat on.
So do we know anything about that particular part of the trip? You say that she, you know, it was supposed to be on the latter leg of the trip. If she would have made it, you know, to Howland and flown from Howland to Hawaii, do we know anything about what that mission might have been at that point?
Probably not common knowledge. Is they say that in order to keep an aircraft the longest time in the air, we have what we call a maximum endurance airspeed. And if you want to take a flight, a long-range flight, you use a max endurance airspeed, which for this aircraft is 150 miles an hour, okay? And at 8,000 feet, that works out to approximately 174 miles an hour. true airspeed, actually, how fast she's going. But then the wind takes it back to the ground speed, which in her case was around 130 miles an hour. excuse me. We also have what's called a maximum range airspeed, okay? And normally that max range airspeed is either the top speed of an aircraft or the fast cruise airspeed of the aircraft, which is 190. Actually, it works out to 205 miles an hour, I believe, for this aircraft, the E model, Lockheed. That, of course, uses more fuel than the max endurance airspeed. So you don't stay airborne as long, but you go further. That's basically what it boils down to. I have seen no one actually address the maximum range airspeed of this aircraft. They always address the maximum endurance airspeed. Her flight time from Holland Island to Luke Army Airfield on Ford Island in Hawaii at 150 mile an hour cruise would have been 12 hours and 3 minutes. Okay, that's calculated according to the profile that Kelly used. The total flight time would have been 12 hours and 24 minutes. Okay. Now, if she had done the mission that we feel that she probably was scheduled to do, was from Howland Island to a little island on Mailop Atoll called Toroa. And that would have been, she would have had to have flown, first of all, to Toroa and then to Hawaii. The total time for that trip would have been 13 hours and 45 minutes, about an hour and 21 minutes difference, okay? Perfectly explainable because she was 2 hours late on her arrival, supposedly, at Howland. So on a flight that long, there's not a problem. To understand the time frame that we're talking about, President Roosevelt was doing everything he possibly could to convince Congress, the League of Nations, and the American people that the Japanese were truly a threat, and that they were, in fact, militarizing the mandated islands, the Marshalls and the Carolines and the Marianas. He had no success at that. We believe that gold would have been photographs of a large Japanese airfield on the easternmost island closest to Hawaii. And they built a huge airfield on Toroa. And they started that airfield in 1935. So in 1937, it was almost finished. And pictures, aerial photographs of that would have given him an unbelievable amount of ammunition, political. Of course, he never got that ammunition, so we can't say exactly if it would have worked or not.
So let me see if I can paint a picture for our listeners and folks out there who are following the project, just to make sure that I have it correct. So at the time, you know, FDR is trying to convince Congress that he needs, you know, this information for the purposes of a future possible war and just for future intel. But his arguments are not cutting it. So, you know, all the while, Amelia Earhart is getting ready to ready herself for this flight that's going to be around the world, that's going to position her to possibly take some photographs and possibly do some recon on a... on an area that we will be very involved with in the coming years. And so he essentially asked her to do this as a favor to him, and she reluctantly agrees to do it. And then, of course, she never makes it back. Is that kind of it in a nutshell? Do I get that right there?
That's it in a nutshell, except I don't think she reluctantly agreed. I think she really was very enthusiastic about it. She was a patriot, and I can get more detailed about what happened before, but you remember her first attempt at around the world flight like this was from east to west, her takeoff in Hawaii was, now that wouldn't have been the right way to do this, okay? Plus, I don't think she had the equipment on board to do it. So why did she crash the airplane at Luke? We're talking about a very experienced pilot, and we're talking about an quote-unquote accident, okay, which required her aircraft to be taken back to Lockheed and rebuilt, at which point even Fred Gorner said in his novel in 65, said that Paul Nance stated that they had installed wing cameras on their aircraft at the time when they did the modifications for them. So somebody crashed your airplane. I don't know who else it would have been. And that would point to the fact that she wasn't quite reluctant about what she was doing.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because we've talked to a lot of folks about the ground loop incident. It's quite famous in Earhart lore, and that really changed a lot of things. We had a lot of folks tell us and talk to us about the fact that, you know, the airplane after that incident was kept in a special hangar. There was a special crew brought in. No one was allowed to see the airplane being repaired and what was really being done to it. And then it took, you know, a combination of 11 different branches of the government to kind of come together and finance the repair of the plane, and that it kind of became something else entirely at that point. Can you talk a little bit about that process and what may or may not have happened at that point once the government took over, repair of the plane and potentially financing the rest of the trip?
You mean as far as the government taking over the flight?
Yes.
They said a lot of her friends have stated that she became a different person after that. And I think it's quite telling that after the plane crash, I mean, she was almost immediately, she hardly stayed at that airfield at all. She was almost immediately aboard a ship headed back for the United States. I found her behavior a little bit strange. Of course, she wasn't exactly like all the rest of us, but she was kind of strange in many ways. Yes, she took the aircraft was shipped back, crated, and shipped back to Lockheed Aircraft. Somebody paid for that. It certainly wasn't her or her husband, so it almost had to be the government that did it, and paid for extensive repairs on the aircraft. And they just did what they wanted with the aircraft. Fred Gorner was under the impression that they installed different engines, and we don't believe that's true. She had more than enough to do what she needed to do. While she was training after the aircraft was repaired, while she was in training, she was training with a gentleman called Mark Walker, who ended up being a co-pilot on a Pan American flight that was, some people say, hijacked a year later. Mark Walker told her that she didn't have the ability and or the equipment to do what she was supposed to do. And she supposedly stated at the time that she had an aircraft that was capable of 250 miles an hour. A lot of people say that that is not possible, but at 10,000 feet, it is possible. Okay, 264 miles an hour, as a matter of fact. But she had that. She said that. Now, he put that in his diary, which wasn't discovered until quite recently, actually, that she had made that statement and that he made that statement. She was woefully unprepared for what she did. Not for the secret mission, quote-unquote secret mission, but for the actual finding of Howland Island. It was not well thought out.
So let me ask you this. Why do you think she would choose to go this route? Why do you think she would choose to do this? Do you think it's just because, you know, she was a patriot and she wanted to do this and her president was asking her to do this? Or in this case, really, it was her friend. I mean, FDR was a close personal friend of hers. Of course, Eleanor was as well. We know that, you know, she needed the funds to get the plane back up and running. And obviously, her and her husband wanted to make her even more relevant than she was and more famous than she was. But why is it that you think that she elected to kind of go ahead and do this and take on this extra task of doing this for the president?
I think Franklin D. Roosevelt was an extremely persuasive man, extremely persuasive. And I think if she had any trepidations about doing it to start with, she didn't after she met with him. That's all really that I would say about it, because I've seen so many things that he's done that nobody should have been able to do, but he did it. He convinced a lot of people of a lot of things.
So she puts the plane down at Mille Atoll. Can you walk us through that process and what happens next in your opinion and in your research? What's the next step at this point?
The next step was that several days later, I believe, the Japanese ship Koshu, which was a oceanographic ship, came to the island. And according to the eyewitness testimony, they put it on a barge. They basically sunk this barge and put the aircraft on it and brought the barge to the surface and towed the aircraft. Or then they lifted the aircraft. They put it out into the lagoon at Mille Atoll, or rather it was out too far offshore. So they towed the barge out to the ship. The ship hoisted it up, took her, Fred Noonan, and the airplane to Jalu first, we believe, and then on to Kwajalein, which was basically Japanese headquarters at the time.
So what becomes of them at this point, and how do you think they're treated when they arrive there?
I think, first of all, they were treated not badly. There wasn't really anything aboard the aircraft that would point to them being spies. I mean, she had a camera, but I think basically they had her because they were terribly suspicious that she had landed. And she basically had landed illegally on their territory. So they were holding her, but I don't think they had any intentions of mistreating her. I think what they did was what most field commanders will do when presented with this hot potato, is they're going to send her to a higher headquarters. They're going to send it up the line to make somebody else make the decision, because they don't want to make it themselves. So I believe that they were put aboard an aircraft and taken to Saipan. And she was kept in a hotel in Saipan, according to testimony. She was kept in a hotel in Saipan, and then she was very sick. She had probably dysentery, and she was very ill. And then she disappeared from the hotel and probably ended up in Garopan prison, where she most likely, according to Fred Goiner and several people, she died in the prison. Now, their problem is they have, as you said, the most famous woman in the world dead. So the next thing I believe anybody would have done it was to, number two, get rid of the next guy, which they most likely executed Noonan, and then make the whole thing disappear, which was rather easy to do since nobody was there to protest it one way or the other. So I think basically her dying was not their. They didn't cause that, I don't believe, except by what they fed her or whatever. But she succumbed.
So either way, though, she dies in Japanese custody, which is tragic. What I wanted to ask you now is I wanted to talk about, you know, FDR and the U.S. government. Do you think at this point, does your research point to anything indicating that they had indeed had knowledge of the fact that Earhart was indeed in captivity, that Earhart and Noonan were there, and that the Japanese government had them? And if so, what kind of knowledge might they have had about that?
Yeah, Admiral Nimitz said that she went down in the Marshals and was in Japanese custody. Admiral Nimitz is, I was born on his birthday, by the way. He basically said that she went down to the Marshall Islands and she was captured by the Japanese. Of all the people around, he might have had the most knowledge of that, or been terribly knowledgeable about that. There was a lot of things that happened after the war trying to locate her or any sign of her. So they had to have known it, because you've got to remember they were reading Japanese code at the time. So they probably would have known. Now, there was one Japanese code, the Admiral's Code, which we never cracked. We have no idea what they were saying. And my thought process is that an awful lot of really what happened was might have been put forth in that code that we could never have been able.
Do you think there was... Well, let me ask you this. How long do you think that, timeline-wise, do you think that she's in Japanese custody before she dies?
That's really difficult to say, but... because nobody seems to be able to root it to a time. My guess would be before the end of the year, by about December or so, November, December time frame.
So in that time, do you think there was any communication between governments? Was there any negotiation kicked off maybe to possibly send someone there to maybe bring her back in that time frame? Was anything like that ever done, do you think?
No, I don't. Because to do that would have given away the fact that they were reading their dispatches. The U.S. or any government has a tendency to keep that a secret, and anything that would point to that. The Ultra Code that they used after World War II started is a perfect example. That stayed secret until 68. So no, I really don't believe that they made any effort other than the normal, have you by any chance seen her? No, we haven't, that sort of thing.
So now here comes the punchline of this podcast and of this interview. She's in Japanese custody at this point. The United States government knows, the president knows. I'm going to ask you just another point blank question, because I think it's obviously relevant at this point. Did the United States government betray Amelia Earhart?
It had to. You got to remember what the time frame was. FDR was not doing well. The Supreme Court was reversing some of his programs, and he was in trouble himself as far as what he was doing. And then all of a sudden, he's going to be known as the president that turned his back on the most famous woman in the world. He would have had every reason to keep that secret, because he couldn't get her out, and he couldn't admit that he was partially responsible, which he was. The finding, just as an aside, the trip from Le New Guinea to Howland Island, they had to find an island out in the middle of the ocean that was 2 miles long, 1 mile wide, 8 feet above sea level, after they had been flying for 20 hours. Now, you've got to remember, they're not flying in that 727 or whatever it is that we're flying now, the 767. They're flying with two reciprocating engines, no sound attenuation because it's all been taken out. Fatigue is a huge factor. So they're stacking the deck against themselves to start with just by doing that. When she was doing it before the first trip, she had four people on board. She had Paul Mance as a co-pilot. She had Noonan and Paul Manning as navigators. And they had everything in place ready to find out. I think one of the interesting facts was that they only took like 785 gallons of fuel was all they took. And that would have given them a 40-minute reserve or a 44-hour reserve to find the Gilberts if they had to go there. It was the best thing to do. Their flight time was less, everything was less. And they could find that tiny little island. Now, flying from Howland Island to Le New Guinea, there's an awful lot of ground that they could go to, it would have been fairly easy to find New Guinea, whereas finding Howland Island was difficult. So by reversing the course of the flight, that in itself was one of the first steps.
Okay, so I guess I'm a little floored, just because I think it's, if this is indeed the case, and this is indeed what happened to Amelia Earhart and to Fred Noonan, I think it certainly makes for one of the most tragic endings to, you know, a heroic figure ever. What I really want to do now is I want to kind of move on to the witness testimony. As you mentioned, and as we've talked about in previous podcasts, there's over 200 eyewitnesses scattered throughout the Marshall Islands and Saipan, from various backgrounds, that are kind of corroborating this testimony, saying that she and Noonan were in fact there. Of course, you mentioned Admiral Chester Nimitz earlier in the conversation, and he's, you know, about as good as it gets when it comes to military rank and class and to reputation. Can we speak about eyewitness testimony in general, and can we speak about how important that is in a hypothesis that you're working like this?
It means a lot. I know that courts recently, or within the last few years, have started discounting eyewitness testimony, but as being unreliable. But that sort of testimony, if you think about the time frame, that is, I think, the key here is the time frame. We have to take ourselves back to 1937, when most of those islanders, they'd never seen an airplane before. They didn't know what an airplane was. There weren't thousands of them flying over them on, you know, every year. They didn't, a person who heard an airplane at night, come on. You don't hear that all the time. And an airplane with reciprocating engines on is a lot louder because they're flying lower and their engines are louder. Here's these people, they describe an airplane very, very similar to hers as crashing on Miley Atoll. I think you have to take that into consideration. Is today we might be able to discount that testimony because everybody and his brother knows about Amelia Earhart, but that guy that first reported having seen a twin-engine silver aircraft crash on Miley Atoll, he didn't know Amelia Earhart from Adam. He didn't know what was going on. And then to describe a woman dressed as a man, they weren't used to seeing that, and a rather tall guy, tall skinny guy with her, it leaves the realm of just possibility and enters the realm of probability. The eyewitness reports and what they said about her in Saipan, the details that some of the people went into, I don't know. It's extremely difficult. The only thing about the Saipan eyewitnesses that I question are the ones that said they saw her airplane destroyed. I don't really believe that the Japanese had any reason whatsoever to take her airplane to Saipan, but I believe they took her and Noonan to Saipan. They left the Electra in the marshes. And ironically enough, we have a friend, a fellow investigator, Woody Rogers is the name he goes by, who feels like that airplane was taken to Toroa, which was, believe it or not, the very airfield that we think that she was going to photograph. It was the largest airfield in the Marshall Islands at the time, and it would have been the place to keep it.
So let me ask you this. In your opinion, is the Electra still out there, or do you think it was destroyed a long time ago?
Well, I don't think it's in great shape, but Woody, and he knows, of course, a lot more about this than I do. He and I have talked several times. He believes there was an admiral in charge of the airfield at Toroa, and Toroa was bypassed by American forces, so they didn't surrender until after the armistice. Rather after the surrender. He feels like that the admiral was told to keep the aircraft a secret Now, that was the last orders he got, so he feels that he buried it, there on Teroa. And before the State Department got in and started getting rid of all the unexploded ammunition, because if you look at the photographs of Teroa, it was unexploded ordnance, exploded ordnance. The Allies mauled it. They used it for target practice, both ships and airplanes. So there was a lot of unexploded ordnance. But I have a tendency to agree with Woody that the aircraft most likely, what's left of it, is probably still buried on Teroa in a bunker someplace. There's still an awful lot of airplanes on Teroa, Japanese aircraft. So I don't. That would be my guess. That would be the logical place to take it.
So let me ask you this. Do you think if the plane was discovered there, or whether it's the remnants or, you know, some part of the wreckage or even intact in some way, shape, or form, do you think that would help push the hypothesis and further solidify kind of all the work that you guys have been doing?
Oh, God, yes. I mean, without a doubt, it would be tantamount to finding the Holy Grail for any investigator, because the fact that it would be found in the Marshalls and the fact that it was found in a Japanese-held airfield, come on, it basically says the whole thing. It tells the whole story.
You know, when I talk to children about Amelia Earhart, one of the aspects that I really like to lay out is the fact that this is a woman that was truly fearless. She seemed to have a real grasp on the concept of fear and not letting fear show through. And I think her lifestyle and just the things that she accomplished obviously demonstrates that. But what I want to ask you about now is, for a woman who seems to have conquered fear, if she is in fact captured by the Japanese, if she is taken to Saipan, and, you know, with or without Fred at this point, depending on who you talk to, what do you think her morale was? How do you think that affected how she thought, how she felt, knowing that she could very well die here, or at the very least live out the rest of her days here, and not ever come back and see her friends, her family, the people she loved? How do you think that affected her morale-wise?
I think it lowered her morale greatly. And I think that's probably one of the reasons that she succumbed to her illness. I can't feature that Amelia Earhart, as strong as she was, would have succumbed to an illness so easily unless her immune system had been at an ebb. And your morale will put your immune system at an ebb.
So let me ask you this. As we speak, there's a lot of folks, a lot of groups looking for Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, looking for the plane, looking for the remnants of bodies, searching for the truth and what happened to them 80 years ago. What do you think Amelia Earhart's legacy is? How do you think that works? And what do you think ultimately, 80 years after she disappeared, is her legacy?
Well, I think her legacy is the fact that she always promoted women to be independent, to be fearless, and to do what they wanted to do. I think that's pretty much been fulfilled, or is in the process of getting there. So I think that would be what her legacy was, and I feel like that if she felt like that she contributed to that, which I do think she did, quite a bit. I mean, even just a few years later, the Women's Army service pilot, the WASPs, were flying many missions, and many of them died flying those missions. They didn't die in combat, but they died just the same. I think that would have been her legacy. And as far as remembering her, I doubt very seriously if she would believe how much attention she's getting.
It's been 80 years since the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan. It's often referred to as the most famous missing persons case in the history of missing persons case, and it remains unsolved, obviously, to this day. What do you think it is about this particular case and this particular woman and man that continue to capture the attention of the entire planet 80 years after they disappeared?
it may sound a little jaded, Amelia Earhart was not anywhere close to the best female aviator in the world. There were many that eclipsed her. There were many that accomplished more than she did. She was, hands down, extraordinarily popular, probably more popular than any other female aviator, and probably second only to Lindbergh. I think that what captures everybody is just that nobody knows what happened. Nobody knows for sure what happened. We can guess all we want to. I work trying to locate POW and MIAs from Vietnam, and I find that the families all feel the same way. They are fairly certain that their loved one is gone, is dead, but they just want to know what really happened. And I don't think that, it's just that, I think if she hadn't disappeared, probably people today would say, Amelia who? That would be, I think that's exactly what would happen. Most women today, I don't think would accept what she did. You have to remember that in her marriage vows, she refused to use the word obey. And that was unheard of at the time, but she was just that kind of a person. She felt like that women were equal to men, and she went about proving it.
Can you tell everybody out there listening to the podcast here where they can find and purchase the book online, and also is there a revised version of the book coming with revised data?
No, we're planning on doing it, but we're planning on incorporating it with more stuff from that particular time frame. There's a whole bunch of stuff that we've uncovered while doing the investigation that's almost as interesting as her. They can get the book at Amazon, either electronic or a hard copy. Barnes & Noble, just about any place where you can pick up books. We have a website. It's called Amelia Earhart Betrayed, and there are several things on it. We put new things on there all the time. We have a paper that we wrote called Tragedy of Errors. In the military, when you have an accident, they use a method of trying to figure out exactly how far back do you have to go to find out where did the accident really start to happen. And we put together a paper on that, just exactly where we feel that it happened. And of course, that was, as far as we're concerned, where she reversed the direction, was where the whole thing started. But we do stuff all the time and put it on there. So writing a book takes a lot out of you, believe me. And we probably will be several years before we come out with anything different.
Robert, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you today. Thank you for hopping aboard the Chasing Earhart podcast.
You're welcome.
So the book is Amelia Earhart Betrayed by authors Robert Wheeler and Harold Nicely. You can pick it up on Amazon, or you can go right to their website and you can learn more about the book and their story and their research. I highly recommend it. It's a great website, very informative. Now, before we head out for the week, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about next week. We like to preview each guest before they come around the podcast and kind of get everybody ready for what they're about to experience. And next week is no exception, and next week is going to be mighty interesting indeed. So our guest on the podcast next week is Gary LaPook of the Stratus Project. He is one of the foremost authorities on the planet when it comes to celestial navigation. We sat in with him on a very special live edition of the podcast. We were actually recorded it live in his home, and we talked to Gary for a little over 2 hours. So we break down an awful lot of information. It's going to be very informative and very lengthy podcast. We're very much looking forward to bringing Gary to your ears so you can get his perspective and his thoughts on Amelia Earhart, the crash and sink hypothesis, and the numbers, the celestial navigation, how that all breaks down. It's going to be a very great podcast, and we're very excited to bring it to you. So that's next week on Chasing Earhart with Gary LaPook. Until then, this is Chris Williamson, the project creator of Chasing Earhart, and we will see you next week.